AM 1080 KSCO. Here now is your host for today's program, Ruth Copeland.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Welcome to the show. In case you're a new listener, a bit of background on me. I'm British, as you can probably tell, but I've lived in Santa Cruz for over 10 years, and I'm also an American citizen. I have a professional background in the arts, in music writing and performance, and also psychotherapy and business. And you may have heard me on another KSCO show, It's the Way of Love, live. If you're new to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland, in the first hour, we look at all kinds of topics from all kinds of angles, attempting to see if we have more in common than divides us, and focusing on debate rather than one-sided conversations. And we keep a balance between the intellectual and the arts, with the second hour featuring an in-depth interview with a guest from the arts. You're listening on KSCO AM 1080, or maybe to the live stream at ksco.com, which enables us to have listeners around America and the world. So welcome. Today in Santa Cruz, we're having a bit of a grey wintry day, finally. It's been so sunny here, it's hardly felt like winter to me, so I'm quite happy, really. Feels just nice and wintry. I think it's nice to have seasons, just to have the contrast. So it's our very brief winter is occurring right now. Anyway, in the second hour today, just after three, I'll be talking to Laurie R. King, award-winning, internationally best-selling author of over 25 books, including the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series, Kate Martinelli books, and novels, including her latest, The Bones of Paris. Since her first book in 1993, Laurie has gathered multiple nominations for prizes and won many prestigious writing awards, including The Beekeeper's Apprentice being chosen as one of the top 100 favourite mysteries of the 20th century. A third-generation Northern Californian who has lived most of her life in the San Francisco Bay Area, she's also spent a considerable amount of time in Britain. And her background is as mixed as any writer's, from degrees in theology and managing a coffee store to raising children, vegetables, and apparently the occasional building, according to her. Not sure what that's about, but maybe we'll find out. And if you're not familiar with it, the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series allows King to explore all sorts of ideas and forge an unlikely relationship between two remarkably similar individuals who happen to be separated by age, sex, and background. The five Kate Martinelli books, however, feature a modern homicide detective based in San Francisco. And Laurie has also written non-fiction standalone novels and the Stuyvesant Gray books, the latest of which is The Bones of Paris. So do stay with us till three if you can and hear what Laurie R. King has to say about her life and work here in the studio with me. So what have we got coming up this hour? Well, with the holidays upon us, the question we're considering this week is, what is the true nature of a gift? Historically, many tribal groups circulate a large portion of their material wealth as gifts. And a gift is given in the knowledge that it will keep being given and never be stagnant. In contrast, in Western society over the last 30 years, we've seen the commodification of things that in the past would have seemed beyond the reach of any market. This is something we discussed in an earlier show a few weeks ago, or maybe a little bit longer than that, but fairly recently. And I'm wondering, has this changed how we think of gifts? Do we now think of gifts predominantly as material items? Has gift-giving become a barter exchange, where we try to give gifts of equal value to what we will receive? Has gift-giving become largely an obligation? Or is there still real joy in it? Why do we give gifts? And also, what about gifts that aren't things? Our time, caring, thoughtfulness, creativity, the sunset, the ocean, the mountains, a child's uninhibited laughter, the love of someone dear to us, the caring of a stranger. Do we think of these as gifts? Is a true gift something that is offered freely with no expectation of return? Is our idea currently of gift giving relegating those with less wealth to a gift exchange wilderness of disappointment and shame? Should we push back against this commercialization of giving? And if so, how? What do you think? Join the conversation. If you have any thoughts on this or experiences to share, do call the studio on 831 479 1080. I'd love to hear your comments. So, what is the true nature of a gift? In his book, The Gift, Lewis Hyde talks about a whole culture of the gift that isn't much thought of now in our society. Many tribal groups circulate a large portion of their wealth as gifts, and tribesmen are enjoined from buying and selling food, for example. And although there is a sense of what is whose, food is always given as a gift and never subject to barter or purchase. And not surprisingly, thinking of part of your wealth as a gift makes people live differently. And when gifts circulate amongst a group, a decentralized cohesiveness emerges. The community is enhanced and broadened. As aviator and writer Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, I always have a job saying that name, says, in giving, you are throwing a bridge across the chasm of your solitude. And I thought that was a beautiful way of expressing what true gift giving is all about. And the sociologist Marcel Mauss noticed that gift economies tend to be marked by three obligations: the obligation to give, the obligation to accept, and the obligation to reciprocate. However, in these gift exchange cultures, it's nothing like our idea of giving someone a gift and getting one in return. The cardinal idea of gift cultures is that whatever has been given is supposed to be given away again, not kept. Or, if it is kept, that something else is given away in its stead, but not back to the original giver, to someone else. The idea being that the gift should always be on the move, and that a wider relationship is created this way than a transaction between just two people would create. And Lewis Hyde considers the complete misunderstanding of the gift exchange culture of the native people of America by the early Puritans. Having been offered the peace pipe and a smoke by the indigenous people, the Puritans didn't understand the desire of reciprocity on the part of the Native Americans. Why should they give the native their pipe just because they had given them one? Where was their understanding of private property? The term Indian giver arose, denoting someone who gives with an expectation of some return. Hyde suggests that the opposite of Indian giver would be white man keeper, a person who wishes to remove property from circulation and use it to bolster their own possessions or wealth. The native people understood something about the gift that the Puritans did not, that a gift ceases to be a gift in the true sense unless you have given something else away. In this way, the cup is kept overflowing. So what do you think? Why have we lost the ancient gift exchange idea of a gift ceasing to be a gift if it is not passed on? How did we get into more of a barter exchange view of gift giving, which is where we seem to be largely now? Call the studio on 831 479 1080. I'd love to hear your comments on this as we consider what is the true nature of a gift. And we're going to go to a commercial break now, but I look forward to coming back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080. Come on, girl.
Hi, registered pharmacist Ben Fuchs here. I've been studying healthy bodies for 35 years, and what I've got to tell you may shock and surprise you, but if you listen up, It may change your life. For you guys who are dealing with low T issues, if you're older, if you find that you're in the gym and you just can't gain the muscle mass that you want, or you're getting body fat, you can't get rid of belly fat, or if your sex drive isn't what it used to be, or if you're using testosterone or androgel and you're not getting the benefits that you want, chances are your body is an estrogenic female hormone, estrogenic mode. Estrogen, of course, is much more than a female hormone, but it does have feminization properties. Also, chances are pretty good that you're dealing with insulin resistance. So if you're having problems with testosterone, either low T or low T effects, if you're in the gym not getting the benefits that you want, or if you're taking testosterone and not getting the benefits, the chances are good either A, that you're dealing with excess feminization, excess estrogen. Estrogen is a stress hormone, and it's made in body fat. The more body fat you have, the more estrogen you're going to be producing. Men and women, folks, men and women. If that's not a reason to get rid of that body fat, I don't know what it is, guys. Body fat means feminization. So losing that body fat is the first thing that you want to do. There's also great anti-estrogenic foods you can use. Probably the cruciferous vegetables are the most important of the anti-estrogenic foods. Broccoli, kale, cabbage, cauliflower. If you don't like those kinds of foods, learn to like them. One of the great tricks that you could use for broccoli and cauliflower, these medicinal cruciferous vegetables, is to steam them, use butter and salt. Wonderful anti-estrogenic foods.
Many Americans are dealing with chronic diseases every day, such as diabetes, heart disease, back, joint, and muscle pain, not to mention gastrointestinal disorders like acid reflux, GERD, colitis, irritable bowel syndrome, diverticulitis, and heartburn. According to the CDC, nearly half of all Americans take at least one prescription drug daily. For those over the age of 60, almost 40% are taking at least five medications each day. So if you're tired of taking expensive drugs with horrible side effects and would like to find another way, Youngevity has the answer, because many chronic disease states can be prevented and even reversed, as they're often the result of nutritional deficiencies and poor lifestyle choices. To order or for more information on how you can manage your health naturally, go to KSCOteam.com. That's KSCOteam.com. Do it now.
Michael Olson checking in with a little story for the season. One day a lady came into the Lions Club Christmas tree lot and said, "I want the seven ugliest trees on the lot." "Oh," I said, "why would you want the ugliest trees?" "Because," she said, "I'm going to take them to my church and have a big decorating party. When we're finished with those ugly trees, they will all be beautiful, and their transformation will make everybody in the congregation very happy." Merry Christmas.
Hello, this is Donald Davidson, the host of the Perspectives radio show on Saturday at 12 noon. We have a variety of programs, from constitutional rights and issues to controversial alternative health views. We interview well-known authors from many walks of life, attorneys from many fields, and internationally known health doctors. So, to hear a different perspective, join me, Donald Davidson, special guests and regular guest hosts every Saturday at 12 noon for the Perspectives radio show, right here on KSCO.
People are talking on AM 1080 KSCO.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. When you started out with...
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. We've been talking about what is the true nature of a gift. We're heading into a gift-giving time of year. And just got me to thinking. We've been talking about how historically in native cultures, the idea of gift exchange has a different kind of resonance. The idea of a gift is that it keeps on giving. And when you receive a gift, that you actually should at some point pass it on. And if you don't pass that gift on, that you should pass on something else, so that there is this kind of circular idea of continually flowing bounty. So I'm wondering what you think about gift giving, what it means to you, what you think the true nature of a gift is. And in many native cultures around the world, to possess is to give. And though one may wonder what will come in return for one's gift, this is never supposed to be brought up. Gift exchange is not a form of barter. And this idea, I thought, gives the term re-gifting a whole new meaning. It's not using a gift you've received but don't actually want to give someone else to save money. It's a flow of bounty. What goes around comes around. And some semblance of this original gift-giving significance remains in our culture. But part of it has got distorted at times into the feeling of obligation that if someone gets you a gift, you have to reciprocate. St. Francis of Assisi's statement, "For it is in giving that we receive," has become rather literal. Thus begins the worry of giving a suitably equivalent present to the giver of the gift. The annoyance even, maybe, when we have to buy a gift for someone we didn't expect because they've given us a gift. This is where the two-way transaction of gift-giving diverges from the ancient gift-exchange culture. Two-way gift-giving can easily become a commodity exchange, where the whole point is to keep the balance of consumption. Gift exchange traditionally moves in a circle, but if there's any two people involved, it creates a line where the gift never passes out of sight. And in this case, the personal ego is more likely to become involved, and the participants are more likely to begin thinking like salespeople. So what do you think? Has gift giving become a barter exchange where we try to give gifts of equal value to what we will receive? Has giving a gift become largely an obligation? Or is there still real joy finding the perfect gift for someone? What does giving a gift mean to you? Do you give with no sense of a return? Or would you be hurt or annoyed if the recipients of your gifts don't give you a present too? Call the studio on 831-479-1080. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this or your experiences of gift giving or receiving. And I know there was Rosemary was showing me a letter into the Sentinel from somebody who was very concerned about Christmas and gift giving, who had not very much money, lived alone, was going to their family, and was very concerned that they were not going to be able to afford that kind of present that they would like to give, or possibly even what would be expected, and how they would deal with that. And, you know, it was making them feel very bad about not being able to give, and also, I guess, embarrassed and possibly even ashamed that they weren't able to give the presents that they felt they would like to or that perhaps were expected. So this got, you know, all of us to thinking quite a bit about, you know, what does gift giving mean in our culture now? What do you think? Give us a call here on 831-479-1080. And talking about native peoples, in some gift-giving cultures, the gifts pass not only between members of the tribe, but also through a third party represented by nature or the divine in the form of offerings, prayer, or sacrifice. And by making this part of the gift exchange process, it allows an understanding of how life on earth is not a simple give and take or even a take and take proposition, and it prevents the view of the environment as a commodity to be possessed and exploited. It encourages a sense of balance, symbiosis, and abundance. So this idea of the gift exchange making us think about more than ourselves and what we're gaining as gifts from the environment around us, from the people around us, and what we're offering also in exchange back to those people and the environment around us. And researching this idea of gift giving, I came across an essay by the American anthropologist Marshall Salins called Stone Age Economics. And it's quite interesting because it postulates that hunter-gatherers were the original affluent society, rather than has previously been assumed that they were just primitively living in constant lack, wondering where the next meal and dry roof was coming from. And the basis of Salin's argument is that hunter-gatherer societies are able to achieve affluence by desiring little and meeting those needs, desires, with what is available to them. And he calls this the Zen road to affluence, which states that human material wants are finite and few, and technical means unchanging, but on the whole, adequate. Now, he compares this to the Western way towards affluence, where, as he puts it, man's wants are great, not to say infinite, whereas his means are limited, and the gap between means and ends can eventually be narrowed by industrial productivity. So he's saying basically that the hunter-gatherer and Western societies we have today take separate roads to affluence, the former by desiring little, the latter by producing much. And I thought this was a really interesting idea, and I'm wondering what you think about this. If we apply the idea to gifts and the gift culture in the holidays, would the Zen road to gift-giving involve requiring and being satisfied by little? And does the Western way involve giving as much as we can afford? So what do you think? Do you feel obliged to try to give materially equivalent gifts to the people in your life? Or do you think that a gift is only a gift if given freely without any expectation of return? What do you think? I'm just wondering. I think for a lot of people this time of year is a pressure, even if you feel that you really like giving gifts and that it is fun to try and find the perfect thing for somebody, that there's still a pressure of obligation, of what people are expecting, of perhaps what we expect from ourselves when we're giving gifts. And I think this is something that definitely comes to bear with children, that people often feel that, you know, the children want certain things, the media is telling us that we should, you know, provide our children with certain things, that latest toy, game, whatever it might be. And that if we can't provide that for our children, then somehow or other we're deficient. And I'm just wondering what you think about this. Do you feel that pressure from the media? Does this interfere with your gift giving? If you have any thoughts, do call 831-479-1080. And, you know, how does this affect people who don't have as much money? And, you know, I was referring to another show we did called What Money Can't Buy. And the point of that show was that the more that money can buy, the more it matters if you have it. And I think this really applies, you know, to this area that we're talking about of gift giving as well, particularly if we see gifts as material things. So I'm just wondering, what do you think about this? Do you see gifts as material items? Do you feel that you have an obligation to give certain people gifts, or is it still a joy for you? Call the studio, 831-479-1080. And I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of talk about market triumphalism, how the market has kind of gone into all areas of our lives. The commodification of things that in the past would have been beyond our reach. And I'm just wondering, is the prevalent idea of gift giving relegating those with less wealth to a gift exchange wilderness of disappointment and even shame that they're not able to give gifts to the level that they would like? And, you know, if we are seeing this commercialization of gift giving, if we think it exists, should we push back against it? And if so, how? How do we do that? Do call the studio with your thoughts, 831-479-1080. I'd love to hear what you think about this. It's such a busy time of year for everybody. Everything seems to kind of get very concentrated. And on top of that, we've got this whole worry about gifts. So we've got Marsha in Carmel on the line. Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland on KSCO.
I love this topic. It's a sore issue with me these days, so I've kind of decided that I would just kind of throw up my hands and say, okay, we're not doing this year. But on your comments that I think I want to go back to the pilgrims or the early European settlers from here, I think they had definitely an ethnocentric view. I think that they viewed themselves as superior because look at what the indigenous population did not have. And their concepts were fairly sophisticated, yet the European settlers were not able to pick up on that nuance. And I think it was a shortcoming one of their several shortcomings. Of course, they came here to this country intending to escape religious tyranny and then establish their own religious tyranny right off the bat. But gift giving is important across cultures, but this economy, it is really, I hate to use the word, capitalist driven. I mean, if we want to really put a wrench in the economy, one of the things we could do is not do what I regard general overspending at the end of the year, because we feel like we're obligated to especially indulge in children, in which some of the things that they want cost hundreds of dollars.
Right. Yeah.
Nothing as mundane as socks, which are very very important and you use every day, but that's not exciting as some of our technological games and that sort of thing. And then and then the element of status that goes along with that, such as ridiculously priced shoes that a lot of kids seem to feel they require.
Right.
I thank you for bringing this up, and I'm really impressed with your program, and I love the fact that you go and read articles on this stuff. I mean, that is truly awesome.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I like to do some research, background research on the topics that I'm doing, and you bring up some really good points. And, you know, I think back to my mother. I know when she was a child, they got one present, and in their stocking they had nuts, and if they were really lucky, maybe an orange. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how we got to this point of, I know, you know, I've been places for Christmas where there's just each child has almost 100 different gifts, you know, I mean, not all very expensive, but I don't know where this kind of idea of having to give so many material things has come from. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, actually, it's, if you want to move the economy along, you know, we spend billions of dollars per year in advertising, and there's no way that, you know, you may get a tiny bit of worthwhile information, but most of it is manipulation, in my opinion, in one way or another to get us to purchase things. And many of those things, life could go on very nicely without. But again, that would kind of cross the wires in our economy.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, going back to this idea of how original gift exchange was, you know, that actually would circulate kind of money through the economy in a certain kind of way, you know. But I also, I don't know if you're aware, in Poland, they have this, the way they celebrate birthdays is if it's your birthday, you give a gift to everybody in your life instead of receiving gifts.
Wow.
So I quite like this idea, because it's like you're going to be getting presents all through the year, you know, rather than just one day a year. So I'm sort of thinking about maybe that would solve some of what you're talking about also, is if we had a different view of gift giving, it wasn't all just concentrated in one period, and we were just doing it perhaps for different reasons, not out of obligation, but more out of joy. Because, you know, I mean, I've asked a lot of questions about why we're doing this, but I know for myself, there's nothing more fun than finding something you think,
perfect gift.
Yeah, that someone will love and that will bring them joy. And, you know, having no care about if they give you anything or what they give you or whatever. I mean, it is a wonderful feeling, do you think?
Oh, yes, it is. In fact, what a fascinating concept of... The other thing that's the problem with the Christmas giving or the holidays, whichever way, whichever holiday, is that you get hit with all of this all at once.
Yeah.
And there's just never enough time between Thanksgiving and Christmas, because that's not how I shop. And when I used to be good at it, I shopped around the year. And I even got clever enough to figure out if I didn't make a box when I found the perfect gift, and it was July, and it was on sale, and, oh, this is absolutely right on the button, I would put the bag in a box that I had designated for Christmas gifts. But I can't and don't shop that way anymore. But I like the idea of year-around, because Christmas is just too much, too intense, everything all at once.
Yeah, I think definitely there's a lot of overwhelm for a lot of people. And, you know, unfortunately and sadly, it does all get down to this sort of rush, I think, of like, oh, God, I haven't got the nieces and nephews, everything, and I must go. And so you don't get that sense of joy that we were just talking about, of like, oh, yes, little Brian would love that, you know, or finding something that's unique that isn't necessarily the, you know, the toy du jour, you know, the most expensive thing.
If you go to one of the things, even as an older adult, I've found that I still love to peruse toy stores. And you find absolutely delightful things these days that may never make it to the mass marketing media. But that takes time.
Yeah.
But there's so much to look at. And we have a store with Thinker Toys, and that's fascinating. I've had adults that say, oh, gee, I'd like such and such, but I've only ever seen it at that place. And that kind of thing, I guess it's still the kid in me, is addictive, even if I just go and look at it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I also wanted to just comment on something you said at the beginning about the native peoples and the lack of understanding. And I think that's really perspective. You know, a lot of this is having the, you know, understanding the perspective of somebody else. And obviously the Europeans coming in just had no means of understanding. Well, they just imposed their ideas and didn't try to really see what could be beyond it. Yeah, but I'm sort of thinking maybe it's got to that point now where we need to take a big step back from all of this manic gift giving and change our perspective perhaps a little bit.
That is the perfect adjective for it. It is manic.
Well, I hope that some of our listeners out there might still be, you know, feeling joyful about this. I know I still have presents to buy, and I'm going to try and feel joyful. But
well, I admire people that can. I just sort of had to concede this year for a couple of reasons. But if people can really enjoy that, that's fine. But it does bother me that it does cause other people to feel bad, such as the lady that you were speaking of earlier.
Yeah. No,
just her presence should have been a treat enough to be able to have her to share the holiday with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's also the issue of people going into debt, you know, at this time because they feel such an obligation to meet, you know, these demands of gift giving. And that really seems to just undermine the whole idea of gift exchange to me.
Thank you for bringing up this topic.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Marcia. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but I thank you for listening to the show, and I hope you might call in again, and I wish you a lovely holiday season, whatever way you're celebrating it.
And safety, happiness, and health to you too.
Well, thank you very much, Marcia, and the same to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. We've got Art and Salinas on the line. I hope you will hold on, Art, over the break and join us as we discuss what is the true nature of a gift. You're listening to KSCO AM 1080.
At her feet was
Craft.
Greetings and salutations. This is Susan Simon wishing each and every one of you a wondrous, witty, wacky, wily, wintry, and whimsical holiday season.
We'll be right back. Shirt Crafter. Your one-stop print shop has been locally owned and operated in Santa Cruz for a decade, providing custom design services to help you build your brand. The Shirt Crafter provides top-of-the-line custom screen printing, digital printing, embroidery, stickers, banners, business cards, and so much more. They carry top-quality brands of gear from T-shirts and polos to sweatshirts and ball caps. Whether you're outfitting your softball team or team building for your business, Shirt Crafter has it all. So build your brand with Shirt Crafter, located at 111 Ingalls Street in Santa Cruz, or go to www.shirtcrafter.com. Or you could give them a call at 831-423-0537. That's Shirt Crafter, 831-423-0537.
We've all heard the term baby boomer referring to those born from 1946 to 1964. There are an estimated 80 million baby boomers, with the first wave hitting the Social Security and Medicare systems in recent years, with more to follow. Many healthcare experts are predicting epidemics of Alzheimer's, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and cancer among this group. However, these impending epidemics can be averted, as there is a new group emerging. This group we call the baby bloomers, because despite their chronological age, they are still physically fit, active, working, and playing. They've heard Dr. Wallach's message regarding diet, lifestyle, and nutritional supplementation. So while many around them diminish in health and vitality, they are blossoming and blooming into vibrant, healthy, on-the-go people. Wouldn't you rather be a longevity baby bloomer? For more information or to order, call Andy or Phyllis Anderson at 888-245-0300. That's 888-245-0300.
Hi, this is Neil from the Our Local Sports Show. This week, our guest is one of the country's premier swimming coaches, Kim Mush, from the University of California, Santa Cruz. During his first 11 years, the Slug swim team has produced over 100 All-American selections, two national champions, and four UCSC Athletes of the Year. In addition, Coach Mush has been honored twice as a UCSC Coach of the Year and a recipient of the American Swim Coach Association Certificate of Excellence for Outstanding Coaching, a record 12 times. Tune in to Our Local Sports this Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. on KSCO.
This is KSCO, Santa Cruz, Monterey, Salinas.
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. You're listening to KSCO AM 1080. And we've been talking about what is the true nature of a gift. And we've been talking about how native cultures had a different tradition of gift exchange, where the gift is just continually passed around, whether it's the same gift or whether it's something else. There's a circle of giving. And we've been asking, do we think now of gifts predominantly as material items? Has it become more of a barter exchange where we feel an obligation to give gifts in the first place and then to give gifts of sort of equal value to what we will receive? Is there still joy in it? And why do we give gifts? And we've got Art in Salinas on the line. Thank you for holding on over the break, Art. Oh, I can hear some other things in the background, Art.
Okay, is it still staticky?
No, it's got a... Well, there's like a voice in the background. Can you sort that out?
Tell him to turn off his phone, or turn off his radio, and that's what it is.
Turn off your radio, Dave says. Have you got your radio on?
No, I don't. I'm clear here.
Oh, sounds okay now. So that was a weird thing. Anyway, how are you, Art?
Doing great. Hey, you know, speaking of gifts, in my family and friends, and more or less this is in retrospect because things have changed throughout the years, it was always the giving part that was the most enjoyment, watching the surprise on somebody. You know, it seemed like that was where I got the biggest kick out of it. I remember one time I gave my grandparents, who were getting up in age, and they had a house with a big double car garage door, and I bought them the garage door opener, and just to see them how they thought that was so handy and thoughtful, that made me feel good, you know. And, yeah. And that's just product at it.
I think that's one of the greatest joys of gift giving, isn't it? Where you give something that is something that somebody loves. I mean, it's even better than receiving something you love. I think that inner feeling of like, oh, that person, you know, I got it right, and they just love it, and I made them so happy. That's beautiful feeling to have.
Well, that is the thought that goes into it. You know, if you think it out, you know, as a kid, you know, you're spoiled. But as you get older in life, you know, it might come down to selecting names in the family. And it is appropriate to take a little time in selecting a gift. And if you get something, just be appreciative of it, whether you like it or not. Somebody went to the time to get it for you. And, you know, that's the holiday spirit.
Yeah. I mean, I think perhaps, you know, ending up with just any old sort of gift kind of thing comes perhaps from this sense that of obligation that people feel that they just have to get something rather than, you know, it being a spontaneous thing of like, oh, you know, I really feel I want to give so-and-so something, you know, to show
yeah.
them.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of factors anymore. You say you have somebody that lives a distance away and you have to mail it. It might cost you more for the postal fees than the gift. So
yeah.
you got to include everything.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, you know, we obviously do feel this obligation to give, even as you say, if it costs a lot to post things. And what do you think about that? You know, I mean, do you think that needs looking at? You know, should there be this obligation to give? You know, and people are upset if you didn't get a present and things like that.
Well, used to in the old days, it was how you acted throughout the year according to the gifts that you got. If you were a good boy or girl, you were going to receive something nice, you know. So I kind of like to think of it in the past, you know. Like I said, for us, it's not a big deal anymore
yeah.
because everybody's kind of split. And you know, when the family's gone, the elders, it's, it changes a lot because they're the ones that installed it on us as kids. And you
yeah.
never match what the parents do for their kids. And you just like to reflect on it during the holidays, and if people enjoy it, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, I think also it's this whole idea of, like, if you've been good, you'll get something. I was talking to the previous caller, Marsha. You know, for my mother, if she'd been good, in inverted commas, that would have mean her getting the doll that she wanted, and she'd have one present, and that would be, like, the highlight of her whole year. I wonder when did it become that, you know, if you're good in inverted commas, suddenly, you know, you've got like 20 presents.
Yeah, I really don't know. I know if it's Christmas morning, you open your first gift up and it's a pet rock, you probably weren't so good that year.
Or even worse, a pet bit of coal.
Yes. Okay, that's funny. Okay, Ruth, you have a great holidays. I imagine you won't be on next Wednesday, so have a great Christmas and talk to you during the new year.
You too, Art. Thanks very much for calling in. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Well, so we're talking here about what is the true nature of a gift? And do we feel an obligation to give gifts? Have we lost this very traditional tribal native idea that gifts are always something that's passed on? The energy of the gift moves through the whole community, joining us all eventually. Has it become more of a kind of commercial transaction? Do we feel a pressure to give the right kind of gift? Has it become too much about money and expectations? What's the, you know, pressure like for people who really just can't afford to give gifts? If you've got thoughts on this, do give the studio a call on 831-479-1080. And when I was thinking about this idea of what is a gift, I started thinking about what about gifts that aren't things? Our time, caring, thoughtfulness, the sunset, the ocean, the mountains, anything that touches us, beauty. What happens if we think about these things as gifts rather than just something that's around us? What if we were to really think of them as gifts? And then if we were to take it one step further and think of them as part of a gift exchange, what would we give back? If we experienced the gift of a beautiful sunset, what would we give back in exchange for that? If we think of things like a child's uninhibited laughter, the love of somebody dear to us, the caring of a stranger, do we think of these as gifts? Do we see them as gifts? If you have any thoughts on this or experiences to share, do call the studio on 831-479-1080. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic that we're doing this hour. And I just want to remind you that coming up just after three, we have award-winning and internationally best-selling author Laurie R. King coming on. So I do hope that you can stay with us for that. And thinking about things that aren't gifts, I see we've got Troy on the line. Going to go to Troy now. Hello, Troy. How are you doing?
Greetings, Ruth. I haven't talked to you in a while. I'm doing fine. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Great show. Yeah, I think gift giving, I tell you what, for me, the best thing about giving gifts is not getting something back nor expecting something back. That's when you see someone else learning how to give gifts and not expecting anything back. That's something good to learn.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that to me certainly is what a true gift is, that you are giving something with no expectation of return. But that does seem to have got a bit lost, particularly at this time of year, I think. There does seem to be this expectation of reciprocity, you know. Do you experience that?
Well, absolutely. I'm just giving away food this year. It's just, you know, just Chinese-made junk in the stores. And, you know, you got the diamond commercials on TV and all this ridiculous stuff. But you know what? The one gift that KSCO listeners and callers could use, that you could perhaps give them, is that instead of focusing on all this negative stuff that we talk about when we call in, what's some tool that we could use to focus our energy better in a more positive way?
Well, I think there's something called appreciative inquiry, which is a discipline that's used in various areas. It's actually used in business consulting, but also in, you know, all kinds of spheres, relationships and everything else. And the idea of it is that we focus more on what's working. You know, we identify what's working, focus on that, and then try to do more of it. And I really think this is the way forward at every level of life, because it takes the focus away from the problems, in inverted commas, which can so easily just throw us into kind of a pit of despair and futility. And it makes us think instead about the good that remains in our lives. And I think on a previous show we had about happiness, I quoted something from a tombstone in England that talked about little candles, how there's all these little lights in our life. And it said, no man is so poor that he doesn't have many of these little candles. And I think that is true, you know, apart from the most dire, you know, circumstances, even in difficulties, most of us have, you know, some things that are okay or even good. And I think certainly in situations where we're trying to find solutions, just banging on and on and on about what's wrong, what isn't working, how terrible this is, it just isn't very useful. You know, it's better to look and say, well, okay, this little tiny piece over here is working really well. Why is it working well? How do we do more of that? You know, and looking into that, you can get some real insights into why something is working.
That's a wonderful answer, and I really enjoy your show, and it's very positive, and we all appreciate it.
Oh, thank well, you. I appreciate that. And I wondered what you thought, Troy, about the native ideas of gift exchange, because I know that you're interested in native peoples.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And it is the way I was raised. It's that we never go to someone's house or enter into another place without bringing something with us and an offering. You know, otherwise you're just a bad hunter.
Right. Yeah. I hadn't looked on it like that. So it's kind of a prestige thing going on.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, and look forward to talking to you again in the new year. So here we are. We're coming towards the end of the show. We still have time to call in there if you have any final thoughts. 831-479-1080. And I wanted to end thinking about gifts of the spirit, our creativity, talent, skills. And George Pepperdine, the founder of Pepperdine University, stated, "A great gift has been made to each and every one of us, the privilege of living in the world for a short span of years and the opportunity of doing our part to help the less fortunate, to improve civilization, to advance knowledge, both the scientific knowledge of men and the wisdom which is from above. The gift of human life and the opportunity which is ours to serve others should be regarded as a sacred trust." And I thought that was a really lovely way of putting, you know, our reason for being here, perhaps. And also this idea of thinking of things that are gifts, that are not just material things. And I'm not meaning in any way in discussing this to be saying that material gifts are bad or wrong and we shouldn't be giving them. I think that there can be a lot of joy, as I said earlier, in finding the right thing, making somebody happy. But I think that the original idea of gift exchange in Indigenous culture, of having a sense of movement of giving and also having this sense of connection to the gifts that are around us in the environment, whatever our idea of the spiritual nature of ourselves is, that there is some connection with that also, that we are being given gifts all the time, every day, if we look at it in that way. And as we've been discussing on several shows now, perspective really seems to be something that's important in how we experience our lives. We can't always change what happens to us, but we can change how we view it and how we deal with it. And I'm perhaps going to end here with a quote from Sir Winston Churchill, who said, "We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give." And thank you very much for listening today. We've got the second hour coming up. I'm very excited to have Laurie R. King in the studio with us. So do stay with us. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland on KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. I'm very happy to have in the studio with me now Laurie R. King, award-winning, internationally best-selling author of over 25 books, including the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series, Kate Martinelli books, and novels, including her latest, The Bones of Paris. And King started writing in 1987 when her second child entered school and had her first novel published in 1993. And since her first book, A Grave Talent, which won the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award for Best First Novel and the Creasy Award from the UK Crime Writers Association, she's averaged a book a year, gathering multiple nominations for and winning many prestigious writing awards, including The Beekeeper's Apprentice being chosen as one of the top 100 favorite mysteries of the 20th century. A third-generation Northern Californian who has lived most of her life in the San Francisco Bay Area, Laurie R. King has also spent a considerable amount of time in Britain, reflected in her character spending time in both these areas. Her background is as mixed as any writer's, from degrees in theology and managing a coffee store to raising children, vegetables, and apparently the occasional building. So I'm not sure what that means. Maybe we can ask her about that. The Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series allows King to explore all sorts of ideas, the roots of conflict in the Middle East and Afghanistan, feminism and early Christianity, patriotism and individual responsibility, whilst also having a rousing good time with revisiting the scenes of The Hound of the Baskervilles and Kim, setting a pair of Bedouin nomads down in a grand country house in England and forging an unlikely relationship between two remarkably similar individuals who happen to be separated by age, sex, and background. The five Kate Martinelli books feature a modern homicide detective based in San Francisco, and the latest book, The Art of Detection, brings about a meeting of the Mary Russell and Kate Martinelli worlds. Laurie has also written standalone novels and nonfiction in what can only be described as a remarkable career. Welcome to the studio, Laurie.
Thank you, Ruth.
So for the benefit of listeners who are not familiar with your career, I'm wondering if you could tell us how you came to start writing.
Oh, I was one of those writers who got started because they loved reading. And you know how it is. You go to the library one time and you just can't find anything that appeals. And so you think, well, if I sit down and write a story, maybe I could keep myself busy longer than just a book would would take.
Right. I read something in your autobiography which is fascinating about the fact that you had a fairly peripatetic existence as a child, and that was one of the reasons that you liked libraries so much. It was a sort of way of finding community.
Yeah, we moved a lot. I'm trying to think. I don't know that there were any 2 years when I was actually in the same school in September that I had been in June.
Wow.
And so, as you say, it's really home to think of a library because it's, instead of having to make new friends and having to face yet another new classroom of people, it's the same familiar faces and friends and titles. And
yeah. Well, I think this is where the appeal of reading comes from for so many people, in that you can make friends with books in a way that you can't if you're seeing a film or something like that, because you disappear into the world of the book. You just can feel that those are your friends, you know, that in, I mean, obviously not like real people, but in your imagination.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that I found myself living in that. I was a great fan of the did you ever read the Walter Farley horse, the Black Stallion and all the rest of them?
No, I didn't.
They were great American classics. And there was a period when I was a child where, you know, I kind of think, in fact, I had to laugh at the idea that that I qualify for the title of your session here, which is balanced, because yeah, I'm honored to be thought balanced, but when I was a kid, I probably should have been in severe therapy, because I spend an awful lot of my time with packages of that plasticine clay, making little horses and telling myself stories about the horses and their lives. So, you know, not really the most balanced individual, but I think it's very true that stories like that inhabit your life.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, you say maybe not the most balanced individual, but, you know, you look today at how a lot of children are spending their time, and I think, you know, spending a bit more time with little plasticine figures and creating worlds and using your imagination might not be a bad thing.
It's true. It's true. I don't think it was altogether a bad thing, but it was just odd.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to me you found the best way of coping. It was a coping mechanism that has led you into storytelling on a much greater scale, hasn't it? So,
sure.
Yeah. Sure. You'll take that one.
Yeah. I haven't started writing horse books, though.
So, speaking with new writers in mind, you've said that they should remember, you are a writer, not the author of a book. Keep that in mind. And that really spoke to me, but I wondered, what does it mean to you to be a writer?
I think the point that I was trying to make with that statement was, is an awful lot of writers who will do one book and then get so involved in either selling it to a traditional publishing house, or now that everyone's putting stuff online, getting entirely wrapped up in the business of selling an ebook online, of promoting it, of packaging it, of interacting with potential readers. And it just seems to me that that's pretty much self-destructive when it comes to a writing career. Because if you have all of your attention focused on that peripheral stuff of packaging the book and yourself, you are not writing. And ideally, you would like to do nothing but write. There's other things that do rear their heads, especially as you go along in this career. But the way that you become a full-time writer is to write.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, I think a lot of the people who go down the ebook route feel that perhaps there isn't another route? I mean, with the way, you know, book selling is going and everything, do you still feel that it is possible to follow the traditional route? I mean, obviously some people still are, but is it realistic to think, okay, I'm going to try and get an agent, I'm going to then get a, you know, proper publishing contract?
Well, yeah. I think that I tend to be very leery of e-books as a career, simply because it's really tough to run yourself as a publishing house. And I am one of those writers who depends very heavily on an editor.
Mm.
My editor is my primary reader. She's not always right, but anytime she objects to something, it tells me that I need to spend some attention on whether it's a plot or whether it's some kind of pacing problem or whatever it is that she as an editor is looking at. It is very difficult to do that yourself.
Mm.
There are probably a few people out there who can edit themselves, but there are an awful lot who think they can edit themselves.
Yes.
And to find a freelance editor who can take your book and polish it is very dicey.
Mm.
So that basically what it boils down to is, if you're writing and you're finding your own editor and your own copy editor, and you are finding someone who can design a cover, and you are doing a marketing plan, I mean, isn't it better to turn that machinery over to a company that does it and that knows what they're doing? I mean, there are drawbacks in traditional publishing, sure. You have less control, and sometimes that's good. And sometimes it isn't. There are people who write the kinds of things that publishing just doesn't recognize what to do with.
Yes.
And you may be one of those.
I think I had another author on, Michael Marshall Smith, and he was saying, you know, that there's, which is what I hear you saying, really, there's a reason in a publishing house that there's all these different disciplines. You know, there's all these different people involved in producing a book. So it's kind of unrealistic to just think you will have all the talents to the level needed to produce an equivalent product. And so at the very least, you should be drawing on getting people from outside. But as you say, it's very hard to know what the standard of what they're doing is for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And if you are turning that all over to a publishing house, that means that you are writing, period.
Yeah. I think that's a big issue for artists. And I know the way the music industry has gone, it's become a huge thing of, like, it's, you know, record companies now don't do the artist development anymore. You're expected to develop yourself and, you know, have a following on the internet and all these things. And like you say, it leaves very little time for the art. It's a bad model, I believe. So I'm with you on that. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland and my guest this hour, Laurie R. King. Do join us after the break.
From Capitola to Carmel, Red Hot News Talk, AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Wonderful time of the year.
Welcome back to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland. You're listening on KSCO AM 1080 and KOMY 1340. I've got Laurie R. King in the studio with me, internationally best-selling author of the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series, Kate Martinelli books, and novels including her latest, The Bones of Paris. And I wanted to send you to her website, Laurie R. King, and that's LaurieRKing.com. It really is just a treasure trove of information about all her books and characters, and it's just wonderfully comprehensive. So you'll really enjoy going there, whether you've read her books or not. I would really suggest it. So, Laurie, I was wondering, do you find genre pigeonholing at all. You know, this idea of being referred to as a mystery writer rather than just a good writer.
I think a lot of crime writers do complain about that. I have never felt uncomfortable being classified as a genre writer. I mean, for one thing, if you look at genre writers as compared with mainstream writers, you probably would find we tend to make a living off of it better. People like genre. People like crime. It is a lovely combination, both, I'm speaking as a writer and a reader, a combination of interesting distraction and mental challenge. And I love the way you can slip in all kinds of strange bits and pieces in a crime novel. Because you're dealing with issues that matter, with life and death, literally issues.
Yeah.
You also feel comfortable with the kinds of issues that that spill over, so that the state of politics in Southeast Asia, the crimes against young officers and gentlemen in the First World War by their
superiors.
All those sorts of things. In a mainstream novel are very tricky to fit in, but in a crime novel they're necessary because they add the kind of weight you need.
Mm.
And they make it a satisfying read and a satisfying way of telling a story.
Yeah. I was wondering if you think, the sort of mysteries are so popular, whether the fact that mysteries get solved is comforting in a way. You know, there's so many things in our own lives that don't work out, that just sort of reading something where there's problems and everything gets explained and tied together and it comes together, whether on a psychological level, whether that appeals.
Oh, I think that's one of the big reasons people like crime novels, is that they do have an end. I mean, any other novel you can just trail off anywhere, and it's about a marriage, or it's about travel, or and you sort of, you don't have a problem that needs a solution. But with a crime novel, you must have an ending. Every so often you'll find a crime novel that tries to sort of get literary and having ambiguity at the end. I don't have any time for that. That's cheating. But the crime novel basically is a quest. It is a quest not only for the truth of who done it and why, but it's also a kind of quest that works on the investigator and the people who are tasked with finding out the truth. And as a quest, you have to get somewhere in order to achieve what your goal is.
And I know you wrote your thesis on the role of the fool in Western culture. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you like to work with archetypes in your fiction, whether you do that consciously or whether it just sort of weaves in.
Archetypes like Sherlock Holmes. Huh? I am often conscious of, not necessarily as I am writing a first draft, because I am a very undeliberate kind of writer, but quite often when I'm going through that and working on making the story actually tell what I would like it to tell, which to my mind is the trickier part of it.
Right.
But during the rewrite, I will often be aware that characters are interacting on a that kind of archetypal level.
Yeah.
That you have a hero who needs to fill a certain role in the story.
Yeah.
The book I'm working on at the moment, I've just realized that one of my characters is indeed a fool, and try and flesh out that side of his character is going to make the rewrite really fun for me.
That's interesting. So you're focusing first on the sort of plot, in a way, of how the story works through. Well, I know you don't plot in advance, but you're in the first draft, you're going through and you're like, oh, good, I've got a story. And then you might go deeper with the nuances and things. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Yeah. My first draft is really a kind of 300-page outline. It's the mechanics of the story. It gets me from beginning to end, and all the pieces kind of mesh.
Right.
But it's not a novel.
Okay.
And it's the rewrite is when I turn that piece of machinery of characters, plot, and setting into a satisfying read and
right.
something that has depth to it.
Yeah.
The rewrite is where I put most of my interest. I mean, it's fun. The first draft
yeah.
is fun. Most of the time, sometimes it's a pain, but the real interesting part is the deepening the characters and really working on how they interact and how they really explore the themes of the novel, which I never know what it is until I finish. I say, oh, that's what this book is about.
That's interesting. And obviously the different series that you have and the standalone novels, they're quite different from each other. And is your process the same for all of them in the terms of you just kind of write, you don't plot in advance?
Not so much. Depends on the kind of book. The Russells are much more organic. And because they're first person, they're you know, she reflects as she goes. Some of the other books are, I have in fact done a lot more outlining in the sense of this needs to happen, then this needs to happen, and then I can go there. And I need to see how the machinery is turning before I can really write, because there's so many complex bits that need to go into that chapter or that section. And in fact, The Bones of Paris, the one that came out this year, was one that I did actually do a lot of that pre-work.
Right.
I don't know. Outline doesn't seem like quite the right term for it, but to sequence the plot in my mind.
I was going to ask you about The Bones of Paris. Publishers Weekly described it as impressive, arresting, a tantalizing mystery. A reader review on Amazon states, I was surprised and disturbed, yet could not look away. The rich and eerie descriptions were as revolting as they were compelling, sending shivers down my spine. It is a no-holds-barred exploration of some of the strangest artistic minds of the time. This is not a book for the faint of heart. Despite the relentlessly macabre displays that take up so much of this novel, I did enjoy it a great deal. And I was wondering what draws you to delve into such darkness, and I guess why you think people like to read about it.
Well, yes, it's one of those things that because so many people know me through the Mary Russell books, which are they're not cozies in the sense that they're whodunits, but they're very much not R-rated, shall we say?
Right. Yeah.
There are certain kinds of stories that you cannot tell in that setting, in that slightly whimsical milieu of as a 15-year-old girl who meets Sherlock Holmes and becomes his apprentice. And you say, oh, right, mm-hmm, sure. And although you can play it straight to a certain degree, there are certain kinds of stories you can't tell. And every so often I will have one of those that is itching away at me, and we'll talk to my editor and say, I want to do this. And The Bones of Paris is one of those. And there will be another one in 2 years that even my editor is looking forward to that one. She's just, hurry up and finish this book so we can get to work on that.
So where is your motivation in telling stories that do delve into such sort of darkness in human nature and perversion and horror? Well, I mean, it's not a rhetorical question. I mean, it's like, you know, obviously there's a whole genre of dark fiction and people like to read about it. And why do you think that is?
There's a lot of those kinds of stories that I have problems with. There are a lot of them that I get the feeling as I'm reading through them, that the writer is getting too much pleasure in torturing women. Mm. And at that point, I begin to draw back, because I think that there's probably a place for that in the world, but it's not in my life.
All right, yeah.
On the other hand, there are dark... Sometimes you have a story that requires dark shadows in order to bring the other stuff to light.
Mm.
And there's such a golden aura over Paris in the 20s that it seemed to me that in order to write about that, you have to have sufficiently black shadows at the same time, because the two have to go together.
Mm. Kind of like a yin yang type of thing.
I didn't think I could be doing the story justice by not having the sort of horror, the grand guignol side of things, because that's what Paris was, for one thing.
Hmm.
And Paris was this fascinating mix of, you know, the city of light that yet had this classical sort of community that sprang up around the grand guignol horrors. Mm. And it was a part of life for an awful lot of people there.
Mm.
And I just, that dichotomy just fascinated me.
Mm. Is it important to you to kind of show the light sort of being more prominent than the darkness, or not necessarily?
Oh, I think that in all my books you can tell I'm very much an optimist. I mean, I don't think I've written any books that... That are really downers at the end. There was one book, in fact, it was the predecessor to Bones of Paris, which is a book called Touchstone.
Right.
And in my first draft, I must have been working out issues, because I basically killed everyone off. I mean, just kind of killed them all and blow them all away.
Yeah.
And then as I was doing the rewrite, it sort of occurred to me that, you know, I didn't need to actually kill off all the characters in order to get the effect I was aiming for.
And, right, yeah.
And so I sort of brushed a few of them off and said, okay, you can just kind of bleed a little and you'll be fine. So it's really, I mean, it is terribly satisfying to, you know, to commit mass mayhem on fictional characters.
That's true. It's that all-powerful thing. I think that's what a lot of people get out of video games, you know, of that sense of power. But
it also means that people don't, you know, look at you quite so easily, and they sort of, you get a little more glances on the side, like, is she really thinking?
Well, I'm glad to hear that, you know, most of your books have an uplifting end, or certainly not a negative end. I think that's... I've asked before in Bookshop Santa Cruz, I'm like, okay, I you know, I don't mind if a book's sad and has difficult parts, but, you know, I kind of want to feel like it's life-affirming by the end. And they're like, And, like, there's nothing they could suggest. I was just like, really? Like, is everything just so depressing? You know? It's like, life is hard. I want to read something where something gets worked out. And I think that's why I was asking you about the mysteries. Like, I'm a big fan of Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
And actually talking, about archetypes, you know, he's often referred to as like Papa, calls himself Papa Poirot. So you've got this sort of like older, wise figure. And I think the Sherlock Holmes figure to some degree in your novels, you know, takes up that archetypal role. That's
yeah. It's been fascinating to see the Holmes archetype branch out into the 21st century recently on media. you know, Sherlock and the CBS One Elementary, that is so typical of how an archetypal image grows, is that it finds a home and flowers in a different setting.
Yeah, I find that interesting too. And your Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series is hugely successful, and Fred Erisman, in his paper, If Watson Were a Woman, says male-female relations, for all the changes taking place in society, are at the heart of the Mary Russell stories. And I was wondering what you would say is at the heart of the stories, if there is one thing.
Well, I started the Russell stories as a way of looking at I mean, The Big Eber's Apprentice is a coming-of-age story of an extraordinary young mind. Here's a young woman who is basically a young female 20th century Sherlock Holmes. And what would that mind look like? And especially what would it look like in reflection of the sort of original? And that's what I was doing with those first books. I thought at first that really I wasn't terribly interested in the character of Holmes. The first two or three books, you know, he's an interesting character, but I didn't find him that compelling as a character to develop in a story. Mm. But as I went on and realized that Conan Doyle sold him short by refusing to allow him to come past the Great War. I mean, Sherlock Holmes ends with the Great War, and there was no place for him in the changed Britain of the late teens and 20s. And I thought, you know, that really, as I said, sells him short. That I thought he was a much more flexible character than that. And so I started really looking at him as a character that I could develop after about three or four books. And I found him, you know, they're now an interesting duo to me. They're not just interesting when they get together and snipe at each other, which seems to satisfy a lot of people. But as they both walk forward, that kind of interests me.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go to a commercial break now, but you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland on KSCO, AM 1080, KOMY 1340. And I'm talking to Laurie R. King. And if you'd like to find out more about her books or any information about her, you can go to laurierking.com, LaurieRKing.com. Join us after these messages. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland and my guest of this hour, Laurie R. King, award-winning local author. And you can check out her books and information about her at laurierking.com. And I was thinking the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series. Mary Russell completed her 12th memoir recently. What keeps driving her to record the exploits of herself and Holmes, do you think?
Well, you know, I received all those memoirs in a large trunk, and I haven't got to the bottom of the trunk yet. So, until I do, I will continue to turn out Mary Russell's. Yeah, it's the sort of thing that sometimes you will talk to writers who have a clear idea of where they're going with a series, and they'll have kind of overall arc in mind of 10 stories or 12 stories or however many. And then there's people like me who, you know, not only am I not organized enough to have that, but I think that the Russell stories are much more open-ended, that they kind of follow a certain meandering pattern, but there's a lot of it that I'm not really sure where she's going until she gets there.
Right, yeah. I read somewhere that you said that her character, particularly in the opening novel, is your sort of dream of how you might have been at that age instead of very shy. And
I think that anyone, pretty much any young woman of you know, the age of 14 to 17, secretly would love to be Mary Russell. And one of the early reviews for the book pointed this out, that Russell is for all those people who read the Conan Doyle stories and get to the end and think, but he doesn't mean me.
Right. Yes.
And with Mary Russell, one of the really lovely parts of all of the books is when she manages to get the better of Sherlock Holmes, outsmart him, outwit him, out whatever.
Yeah.
And those are, they're so much fun to write. And I guess they must be fun to read.
Yeah, it certainly seems so. I'm enjoying them, that's for sure. And there's quite a lot of feminist themes just running through the book because of what you're saying, just the idea that a woman, or even a young woman, could be equal to an iconic figure like Sherlock Holmes. And I was thinking, though, about, we accept this idea of disparity in age in relationships when the man is older. Why do you think we have such a trouble with it when the woman is older, which doesn't happen very often because it's so sort of frowned upon? But, or do you think there's something inherent in the dynamic that it works better if the man's older? Or,
well, shall I be politically incorrect and say it's because you expect women to have more sense than marrying a young man? Have I managed to offend all of your listeners now?
Well, but by extension, then, are you saying that the young woman who marries the older man doesn't have any sense?
Probably, yeah. Having been one myself, yeah. No, I think that, this is a question that often comes up, because when you first meet Russell in Holmes, she's 15, and he's in his 50s. And it's, for several years, it is strictly a teacher-student relationship. They are friends, they are partners, as it were, in crime. But there is nothing in the least bit romantic about anything between them. And so I think the tricky bit for me was to make that transition between student-teacher and something that opens up a deeper kind of partnership.
Right.
I think there were a lot of things that went on at the time in the 20s that made it a very realistic situation, because women of Russell's position and age had a limited number of young men to choose from, because so many young men were killed in the Great War, either killed or severely damaged, either physically or mentally. And so an awful lot of young women found that they had to move out of their, marriageable pool of prospects.
Right.
But I think there's also the business of, if you have someone like Russell, who is considerably more mature, it takes a lot of adjustment to find a young man who is that kind of mind.
Right.
I don't know exactly why it works in the books, because you sort of think, ew.
It's a big difference, isn't it? Is it 40
years? It's about that. Yeah.
But at the same time, I suppose, if you think, there's two things. I think there's something timeless about Holmes, and then there's also something about, who people really are, their spirit. If you meet someone whose spirit is just speaking to yours and they happen to be in a body that's 40 years older, then, is that relevant at that point?
Well, since my husband was 30 years older than it seemed not really that far a reach.
Yes, yeah, no, that's right. And I think, my speculation on it is that women are less tied to the physical, so it's easier for them to see what's within, whereas for men perhaps it isn't, it's quite so easy, and that's why it doesn't go the other way so much. But occasionally it does, doesn't it? It seems to be more so these days.
Well, if I ever manage to write a book with Mary Russell in her 50s, we'll see what kind of young man she looks for.
Yeah, and then I guess there's the other side of it, is that how women develop. I mean, the prepossession of Mary Russell at 15 is very believable. I don't know, I'm probably offending lots of people now by saying maybe that same prepossession might not be in a boy of 15. Would you agree with that, or do you think that's sexist in itself?
Well, yeah, except I think that, you know, she doesn't really grow into herself until she hits the 21 age.
Right, yeah.
And she thinks of herself as very mature at 15, but in fact, I mean, it was interesting to write somebody like that who thinks of herself as being more grown up than she is.
Yes, yeah. It's very fun, the whole world surrounding Mary Russell, this idea of the preface of that you found the manuscripts, and it's sort of like taking this story outside the picture frame, as it were, and into real life. How did that come about? I mean, you've kept it going in various instances with fans and things like that, and some people obviously really believe it, it very literally.
It is an offshoot of the Sherlockian idea, the game, that is, to a member of the Sherlock Holmes community, Baker Street Irregulars or not, you begin with the assumption that Sherlock Holmes was a real person, that he lived, he probably still is alive because his obituary has never appeared in the Times of London, so therefore. And Arthur Conan Doyle was his literary agent.
Right.
He was Dr. Watson's literary agent. So that's where we sort of start the game. And I go off from there with Mary Russell. Therefore, you know, if Holmes is real, therefore Mary Russell is real. And I have a lot of fun with some of the books with this sort of metafiction going on, that she reflects how odd it is to be the wife of a fictional character.
Right.
and how she occasionally feels slightly fictional herself, which not the last book, but the one before, which is called Pirate King. I had an awful lot of fun with that because it's all about movies and fiction and real pirates who are not and fake pirates who are. And you know, this whole idea of where is the story and where is the lie is underlies that whole book, but underlies the whole series of,
yeah,
of, you know, yes, these are definitely book memoirs of Mary Russell. I only take responsibility for them because I was given them.
Right, editing them. It's a great willing suspension of disbelief, I think, isn't it? It just adds another dimension to it.
A merry conceit.
There we go. Yes. If you just joined us, I'm talking to Laurie R. King, and you can go to her website, laurierking.com. This is It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and we've got a caller on the line who wishes to speak to Laurie. So are you willing to take a call, or would you rather not?
Oh, it depends. Are they rude or are they polite?
I don't know. I think if they're rude, I'll cut them off.
Oh, good.
Because it's really okay. An unknown factor. So.
Okay.
Okay, Alice, you're on It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and we're kind of hoping...
I don't take calls from people named Alice.
You don't? Laurie, come on.
Hello, Alice, how are you?
Happy holidays, Laurie. How are you doing?
This actually is a ringer in here because this is Mary Russell tweets... And Alice has something to do with that.
Sorry. No.
So should we cut her off now? Is it time to cut her off?
Cut me off, right.
Yeah. My question quickly, because I know we are getting at the end. You mentioned earlier that the book after the one you're currently working on will be a darker book. Is that going to be a continuation of the Touchstone Bones of Paris and finish your trilogy of that?
Oh, no, I think that what I've got is, at the moment, those Bones of Paris came out this year, and then the next book will be a Russell and Holmes, where it's set partly in Japan and partly in Oxford, England. And then after that will be a kind of thriller that is based on a series of short stories that I've written over the years. And it's one of those that I anticipate huge arguments cross-country with my editor as I try and keep as much as possible as the existing short stories in, and she tries to drive me as much as possible to write the material that ties the short stories together. I am already anticipating great battles with that, but she's looking forward to it, and I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Great. Well, thank you very much for calling in, Alice. We appreciate that, and glad we didn't have to cut you off. And happy holidays to you.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, they are. That's the way to determine that all your callers are great, is know them and have So you have a formidable interaction with your fans through your website. We were talking about that in the break. It's very detailed. How do you manage to engage with them so thoroughly and write and have a life?
You're assuming amazing. I have a life.
Okay,
I basically have no life. Yeah. No, it is one of those areas that you have to try and balance. Like we were saying at the beginning, this business of you become a kind of social media nexus, and I think an awful lot of new writers try and do it all. They try and do, you know, Facebook and Pinterest, and they try and do, you know, Tumblr, and I mean you have to choose the areas that you feel comfortable with and that don't eat up your whole life. And I have sort of felt my way over the years into I post on the blog, not often, maybe once a week or so. Sometimes I'll go for several weeks and not do anything and then feel guilty. And I'm fairly active on Facebook. But the others, I can't get interested in them.
Right,
so
yeah.
I figure, you know, if people want to find me, they can find me.
Yeah. No, they certainly can. And you can certainly find all her books, too. And
what I love is when you go to a thing like one of the crime conferences and you find a bunch of your readers there who actually are friends. I mean, they have a dinner together. They have a community that goes on. And I love the online communities that have come together mostly around the Mary Russell stories. But partly about me. I'm invited in.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think that's every aspiring writer's dream. So that's a lovely thing that you have and very deserved. A wonderful career ongoing, and we look forward to new books that are coming out. Again, if you want to find out about Laurie, you can go to her website, laurierking.com. And you've been listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, on KSCO AM 1080 and KOMY AM 1340, Santa Cruz and Watsonville. And I'll be coming back on the show on the 8th of January. The next two Wednesdays are Christmas Day and New Year's Day. So I won't be with you for a while, but I hope you will join me in the new year. And I wish you all the very best, all good things for the new year. It's goodbye from me. 2013 and from Laurie.